that material to Julian Assange was prompted by the Reuters request for it. She had heard that Reuters was after it, so she looked for it, and she wanted to help and explain what happened. And then she was so shocked.
And she was an intelligence officer in Iraq.
She was an intelligence officer in Iraq. And she was so shocked when she saw it that she couldn't help but send it on. Of course, she tried to send it on to other sources, to the New York Times and to other news places, but Julian took it and released it, as you can see.
So why you have edited this volume now in defense of Julian Assange?
Well, there's been so much distraction from what is really at stake here, that we felt that if we put out enough information about what in fact was happening, the threat to Julian and the threat to the Constitution, the First Amendment, and in this country, that people would come back and understand it and get together and fight against this, because that's the only way that this is going to come, that Julian will not be brought to this country, will not be jailed for the rest of his life, and the First Amendment will still exist.
So explain what's happening. He's in jail right now. He faces 175 years in prison if he is extradited to the United States for espionage?
That's correct. There are 17 charges that cover espionage in this indictment. This is the first time that a reporter has ever been charged with espionage. And that is because the press and reporters have always been held up as the most important and only way to reveal what is happening in government. And so far, it has never happened before. The espionage charge is not meant to cover this kind of activity, and the espionage charges in this indictment are, in fact, a violation of the First Amendment. Perhaps I could read.
We only have 10 seconds, but if you can.
I'll try to read very quickly. This is from Hugo Black's concurrence in the New York Times case, in the Pentagon case. In the First Amendment, the Founding Fathers gave the free press the protection it must have to fulfill its essential role in our democracy. The press was to serve the governed, not the governors. The government's power to censor the press was abolished so that the press would remain forever free to censure the government. The press was protected so that it could bear the secrets of government and inform the people. Only a free press, unrestrained press, can effectively expose deception in government.
And those are the words of Justice Hugo Black. I want to thank you, Margaret Kunstler and Tarek Ali, co-editors of the new book In Defense of Julian Assange. I'm Amy Goodman. Tonight, we'll be with Juan Gonzalez at the People's Forum in New York.
Thank you so much for listening to KBOO Portland. The KBOO Evening News is next after these short messages.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Lordy me, yes it's so lordy my, who's gonna be your man?
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society concert season. On Friday, November 22nd, the Honey Whiskey Trio returns to the PFS stage. Prior to the concert, the Honeys will conduct a vocal workshop. Attendees will learn shape note singing, body percussion, and shout songs. The workshop will be held from 3:30 to 5:30 p.m., followed by the concert starting at 7:30, doors at 7. The concert and workshop will be held at Reedwood Friends Church at 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Who's gonna be your man? Oh, Lord, in me, yes, it's so Lord, in my...
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from The Hot Sardines, bringing their jazz to the Newmark Theater on Sunday, November 24th. Tickets available at portland5.com.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from True West, presenting Seattle's Afrobeat Collective Polyrhythmics with Mestizo Beat at the Aladdin Theater on November 22nd. Tickets and information at aladdin-theater.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the sit-in protests at Governor Kate Brown's office against the Jordan Cove pipeline gets 20 arrested.
An Oregonian investigation exposes housing authority neglect on radioactive gases.
And the president raises eyebrows about potentially blocking congressional aid to Hong Kong.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 22nd, 2019. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund.
And I'm Clara Shotto. Thursday night's sit-in opposing the Jordan Cove LNG pipeline at Oregon Governor Kate Brown's office in Salem has not only resulted in multiple arrests, but also an escalated response Friday afternoon. Over 500 people showed up demanding that Brown use her authority to deny the state's permits to allow the intended pipeline's progress. At this time, Governor Brown has refused to do so. Southern Oregon Rising Tide, which organized the protest, said 21 were arrested Thursday evening and were later released early Friday morning. The proposed Jordan Cove Marine Terminal in Coos Bay would allow export of American liquid natural gas to Asia. The pipeline would have a 230-mile feeder from an interstate gas hub in Oregon's Klamath County. 80 protesters gathered Thursday evening prior to the Capitol's closure. Many donned in red t-shirts emblazoned with the words "Power Pass Fracked Gas," refusing to leave the building until requests to meet with Brown were met. Governor Brown addressed the crowd at approximately 8:30 p.m. to answer questions, though she rejected the demand to oppose Jordan Cove. Brown did share a letter she sent to the U.S. EPA opposing attempts from the Trump administration to propose removing state's authority in the permitting process as granted under the Clean Water Act. The Jordan Cove project, proposed by Pembina Pipeline Corporation of Canada, says the pipeline will bring jobs, tax revenue, and outside investments. The hundreds gathered oppose the proposed pipeline's encouragement of fossil fuel usage and ultimate contribution to climate crisis. Spills from the intended project could also devastate terrestrial and marine environments.
Many living in public housing across the United States have been breathing in a cancer cloud of radioactive radon gas, and the government has refused to test for it and remove it. That's what a new investigation by the Oregonian newspaper reports today. Public housing authorities in Portland and other cities have ignored radioactive radon inside homes, leaving tenants exposed without ever knowing it. Radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States and seeps into houses through the flooring. Its risk is not anything new. Indoor radon was labeled a national health problem by federal officials 30 years ago, but local housing authorities ignored the danger. What's more, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, let them ignore it, despite a 1988 mandate from Congress to fix the problem. Oregonian reporters distributed test kits to tenants around the country, and many found levels double the amount considered hazardous. Not only do many local housing authorities fail to test for radon, some of the ones that do test neglect to take steps to eliminate it. While Congress funds most of the costs of public housing, it doesn't cover repairs. So when local authorities are dealing with leaky roofs and other problems, they don't test for invisible gas. Whatever they find, they have to fix, and given limited resources, many elect to avoid it to the detriment of low-income tenants and their health.
President Trump has suggested that he may veto a bill passed by Congress designed to support pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong for fear it may hinder his trade deal with China. The Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act passed the House Wednesday with a vote of 417-1 after the Senate approved the bill in a unanimous vote. With that strong of a majority, Congress could override a presidential veto if Trump were to go through with it. Trump's comments received sharp backlash from politicians of both parties, until the president went on Fox and Friends this morning to voice his competing concerns. There had not been strong indication that considerations of Hong Kong would have any bearing on the trade deal. According to experts, there is enough pressure on the Chinese economy to incentivize a deal, regardless of the U.S. stance on Hong Kong. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, the senior Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, told the Washington Post, quote, "Basic human rights in Hong Kong aren't something Donald Trump can bargain away. Congress has overwhelmingly spoken against the Chinese government's violent repression of peaceful protests, and any action by Donald Trump to side with China over Congress must be quickly overridden," end quote. The president will have 10 days to either sign or veto the law before it goes into effect.
Yesterday, over an hour of public comment at the Longview City Council, Longview City Council voted in favor of a ban on daytime camping. The ban's decision was a result of dozens of tents that have become a familiar sight in front of Longview City Hall. The ordinance would ban daytime camping Monday through Thursday. Violators would face 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. A grace period of 30 days has been granted before the enactment of the ban, and only if an alternative site can be established. As homeless camps have become more prevalent in cities across the country, public response is mixed. Longview resident Bruce Anderson told KOMO News, quote, "Trying to kick them out or run them out of town only makes them someone else's problem," end quote. Some opinion identifies the homeless camp as a statement, making access to City Hall awkward and creating safety hazards due to lack of basic sanitation and bathrooms within the camp, thus forcing the city to address the growing problem. The Kelso-Longview Ministerial Association has plans to open a temporary shelter at a church nearby, but will only be able to operate when the city declares a severe weather emergency of sub-freezing temperatures.
Well, here's a fiery start to the weekend. Police are investigating a fireball that fell from the sky in Polk County last night. The flaming mass was caught on camera and was originally reported as a plane crash. However, in a Facebook post, the Polk County Sheriff's Office said it had, quote, "utilized all available aviation tracking systems and no planes had been lost," end quote. The location of the crash is unknown, but the Sheriff's Office is working to find the landing location and exactly what the fireball is. Users on Facebook suggest the fireball is alien-related, saying, quote, "they are among us," writes one user.
Coming into the holiday season, a new report finds unsafe toys still in stores. Hundreds of thousands of children end up in emergency rooms every year with toy-related injuries. In New York, concerned parents and family members are asking the governor for action. Andrea Sears with Public News Service has more on the story.
Choking hazards, loud sounds, and hidden toxins are some of the dangers still lurking on toy shelves, according to a new report. The New York Public Interest Research Group's 34th annual Trouble in Toyland report says toys have become safer in the past 3 decades, but some toys still on store shelves can be dangerous to children. Hazards like lead paint or toxic chemicals are not easily identified, but Liz Moran, NYPERG's environmental policy director, says some dangers are easier to detect.
Detectable dangers include toys that children could choke on or toys that are too loud. And these types of dangers are ones that parents can be on the lookout for.
The report, available online at usperg.org, identifies hazardous toys still for sale, provides tips for parents and other gift givers, and calls on the government to adopt stronger safety standards. In New York, the Child Safe Product Act, a bill regulating the use of toxic chemicals in children's products, has passed in both houses of the state legislature. However, Moran points out that it won't become law until Governor Andrew Cuomo signs it.
The governor should sign that before the holiday season to send the message to parents that New York State is doing everything in its power to make sure that the products for our children are going to be safe.
The report says many toy slime products now on the market contain dangerous amounts of boron, and some children's jewelry contains cadmium, which can cause cancer and other health problems. Moran adds toys that have been recalled because their safety hazards may show up for sale on eBay or at garage sales.
What needs to happen is more notification from the U.S. Product Safety Commission and manufacturers to make sure that the public is aware a toy is being recalled and why.
Other common hazards include powerful magnets that can be swallowed and uninflated balloons, which are the primary cause of suffocation death in children. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
As Thanksgiving fast approaches, so too does heavy travel at the Portland Airport. The airport expects today to be their busiest day, with 56,000 expected travelers. Next Wednesday before Thanksgiving will be similarly busy, with around 55,000 travelers. This week is also the debut of the canine therapy program at PDX. These trained dogs are here to help travelers de-stress. Kathy Lauder, the handler for one of the therapy dogs, a black lab named Martin, told COIN what role the dogs can play for travelers, saying, quote, "They may be leaving their dogs behind, but they've got another dog for comfort on the concourse."
The nationwide shortage of affordable housing was a topic at the most recent Democratic debate, and two new bills addressing the issue were introduced today. Lily Bulkley has more on this story and others with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Federal government stopped building new housing a long time ago, affordable housing. Also, private developers, they've gone up to mansions. They're not building the little two-bedroom, one-bath house that I grew up in, garage converted to be a bedroom for my three brothers.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren at the Democratic primary debate this week on the nationwide affordable housing shortage of 7 million homes for extremely low-income renters alone, according to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. Yesterday, two bills on housing were introduced in Congress, one by Senator Kamala Harris and Representative Maxine Waters, both from California, a state with a significant homelessness crisis. The other is by Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar. Estimates vary for the maximum amount people should be paying for rent, somewhere between 28 and 30% of their paychecks. But around 8 million people on very low incomes are paying over half. Here's New Jersey Senator Cory Booker's plan.
If you're a renter who pays more than a third of your income in rent, then you will get a refundable tax credit between the amount you're paying and the area median rent. That empowers people in the same way we empower homeowners.
It's notable that the first time affordable housing made its way into the debate was also the first time Julian Castro didn't make the cut. Castro served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under the Obama administration. Here he is in a tweet during that discussion.
Tonight's Democratic debate moderators did something that they haven't done in probably 30 years. They asked a question about housing. That's important because today we have a rental affordability crisis in our nation. I believe that housing is a human right.
And despite not being in the debate, Castro had a great night. It was his top fundraising day of the month. His campaign raised more than it had at the last two debates when he was on stage. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders got the biggest applause of the debate in response to President Trump's new policy greenlighting what international law considers illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank.
It is no longer good enough for us simply to be pro-Israel. I am pro-Israel. But we must treat the Palestinian people as well with the respect and dignity that they deserve. What is going on in Gaza right now, where youth unemployment is 70 or 80%, is unsustainable.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's celebrations in the wake of Trump's turnaround didn't last long, as he was indicted yesterday on charges of fraud, bribery, and breach of trust, on top of his multiple unsuccessful efforts to form a new government. And former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg took one more step in his slow entrance to the race for president, filing paperwork with the Federal Election Commission. But he still hasn't made a public commitment. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bulkey. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Why don't we do it in the road?
Why don't we do it? You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast cast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, The Struggle. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 33. Those clouds continue into tomorrow, reaching a high of 50. Today in history, in 1943, American tennis player Billie Jean King was born. As well as being the former world number one title holder, King is an advocate for gender equality and social equality. In 1973, she won the Battle of the Sexes tennis match against Bobby Riggs. In 1981, she became the first prominent professional female to come out as gay. The quote of the day is from Billie Jean King, who said, quote, "Be bold. If you're going to make an error, make a doozy. And don't be afraid to hit the ball." The Justice Department watchdog finds political bias did not taint the FBI Russia probe, but it documents other errors. Broadly speaking, the report refutes the accusation of a political conspiracy by senior law enforcement officials against the Trump campaign to favor Hillary Clinton. The official report is expected to be released December 9th by Inspector General Michael Hallerwitz. It did not find that political bias tainted the top officials running the FBI investigation into possible coordination between Russia and the 2016 Trump campaign. The report will show, however, that a low-level FBI lawyer altered a document inappropriately, which was used in an application for electronic surveillance of a former Trump campaign advisor. The finding has been referred to U.S. Attorney John Durham so that it may be investigated as a possible crime. That said, the application for surveillance, which was controversial at the time, still had a proper legal and factual basis according to the report. Analysis say that due to its release amidst their impeachment investigation, Republicans will attempt to use it to frame the Justice Department and FBI as politically biased in 2016.
The steelhead breeding population in the Snake River is waning, and Native activists are working to change that. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Efforts are underway by Native Americans to beef up the steelhead breeding population in the Snake River. Steve Jackson reports.
The wild steelhead run on the waterway is one of the worst on record this year, with only 700 fish expected to return from the ocean this fall. 37 wild adult steelhead have been released into the Snake River below Lower Granite Dam. Those fish, all females, will bolster the brooding stock of fish in that part of the river. Unlike salmon, steelhead can migrate to the ocean and return to spawn more than a single time. But few of the fish that have previously spawned make it back that far upriver after their first breeding because of the difficulty in migrating past all the dams. Those 27 fish, known as kelts, have been rejuvenated in captivity for the past few months at the Dworshak and Nez Perce tribal hatcheries. The idea is to make sure they don't have to return to the ocean again and then make it all the way back up past the dam. Doug Hatch is a senior fisheries scientist with the Columbia Intertribal Fish Commission, who says the fish actually stop eating when they begin their spawning journey from the ocean back up to the Columbia River and then into the Snake.
And then, so these fish have gone, you know, 9 months or so without feeding. So we do some pretty specialized fish culturing techniques to get them to go back on feed again and then start introducing a you know, highly nutritious diet. And then that diet, it will recondition those fish as well as then get them to remature.
The kelts are desirable for breeding purposes because they have as many as a third more eggs than the fish that are returning from the ocean for the first time. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs advanced two bills this week to address public safety and missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Savannah's Act and the Not Invisible Act passed out of the committee. Savannah's Act is named for Savannah LaFontaine Graywind, a pregnant Native woman who went missing in 2017. Her body was later found in a river. Lawmakers say her tragic death led to the bill, which seeks to improve the response to missing and murdered Native Americans. It also directs the Attorney General to develop law enforcement and justice guidelines, training and data collection to improve tribal access to federal criminal databases. The Not Invisible Act seeks to improve coordination and prevention efforts between the federal government and organizations. An advisory commission will also be created to recommend ways to reduce violent crimes. The bills now head to the Senate floor. advocates, community members, and policymakers are taking public testimony about missing and murdered Navajo people at a forum in Gallup, New Mexico. The group is working with the Navajo Nation to find missing people and bring justice to families whose relatives were murdered. Navajo lawmaker Amber Crotty is leading the movement.
I did invite more of the family to come, but please understand that these are not stories to be sensationalized. This is deep pain that our families are dealing with. And up until this point, they never really felt that they had a space to talk about it.
Crotty says families, law enforcement, policymakers, and other interested parties need to work together. The two-day forum wraps up on Friday. This is the third such forum held by the working group. An affordable housing development for Native youth opened this week in St. Paul, Minnesota. The facility will provide culturally responsive housing and services to Native young people from 18 to 24 experiencing homelessness. The 42-unit facility includes a medicine garden, sweat lodge, and a place for cultural activities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Health officials say to avoid romaine lettuce grown in Salinas, California, because of another food poisoning outbreak. According to the CDC, 40 people have been reported sick in 16 states. The illnesses are due to the same E. coli strain tied to a similar romaine outbreak this time last year. It is unclear why romaine lettuce continues to present these types of problems. However, the last outbreak was unofficially tied to a water supply contaminated by cattle. Unless it is listed where the lettuce is grown, it is recommended that consumers do not eat romaine. Supermarkets and grocery stores are encouraged to eliminate romaine from their shelves unless they know specifically where it is grown. E. coli is especially dangerous for those with weakened immune systems, young children, and the elderly.
An extremely rare whale, blue whale, skeleton was raised from Yaquina Bay in Newport yesterday after more than 3 years of rest. It took a team of divers and a crane company to lift the whale's 6,500-pound skull and several large net bags full of vertebrae and other bones out of the water. The bones will be preserved and prepared for public display at the local nature center. This particular whale first breached in November of 2015. Such a whale washing ashore in Oregon is incredibly rare, with the last recorded instance being when Lewis and Clark made their journey to the Oregon coast over 200 years ago. Researchers from the Marine Mammal Institute saw an opportunity to use the carcass for public education, so they dismantled the carcass and held it in its nets underwater, letting nature run its course. It will reportedly take about a year before the whale skeleton will be on display, as it needs to be cleaned and preserved.
Listening to the KABU Evening News for Friday, November 22nd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Clara Shotto. Stay tuned for Counterspin.
Thank you.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, calls are coming in for the resignation of Trump policy advisor Stephen Miller after leaked emails show him promoting white nationalist books and ideas to the far-right outlet Breitbart. I wouldn't call the documents a smoking gun. The smoking gun is the 70,000 migrant children held in U.S. government custody over the past year. The emails just reveal the recipe, invoking the same warped great replacement ideas you'll find in the manifesto of a mass shooter, for example. We'll talk with the investigative reporter behind the story, Michael Edison Hayden, from Southern Policy Law Center's Hate Watch. Also on the show, quick question, what happened to Katie Hill? If you're like many, you didn't look too closely. Something-something nudes, something thruple, and the next thing you know, an up-and-coming young Democrat is resigning. Whatever happens with Hill, this vapors-having, best-look-away response is taking a toll, including possibly discouraging other young women in particular from public life. Mallory McMaster wrote about Katie Hill for Rewire.news. We talked with her about the case. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. That White House senior policy advisor and speechwriter Stephen Miller believes in white nationalism is evident. By their policy, ye shall know them. But we now have, as it were, the receipts. The Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch reviewed hundreds of emails between Miller, when he was an aide to then-Senator Jeff Sessions, and Katie McHugh, then an editor at the far-right media outlet Breitbart. McHugh, who has since renounced the right, gave Hate Watch access to